change in it.
This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is Monday, October 18th, 1993. I'm in the Red Gym interviewing Nancy Abraham for the second time, a continuation of the interview we started last week. We're still in the Schoenfeld years in summer sessions at this point. One thing we didn't talk about, a very important item we didn't talk about last time at all, and one I believe you were involved with to a great extent, was the budget. Could you talk about the budget during the Schoenfeld years?
By and large, it was a time of fiscal growth on the campus. And Clay involved me quite early on. Certainly, he was always the final decision maker, but a lot of the digging, the analysis, the preparation for decision making was work that I was most intimately involved in, and that meant a lot of data gathering, a lot of pulling together of information from the summer sessions in terms of student information, faculty data, credit enrollment, student enrollment, that kind of thing. All of that was really under my purview, and Clay would at times suggest that we might begin to look in another area, but as far as how we looked and making sure that it got done and relying on basically what I and other staff did, he really did that. I mean, we did the digging, we did the preparation. I would sit with him and make recommendations to him. We didn't always agree. Sometimes I felt one area should get more money than it was getting for the upcoming summer sessions, but I feel we had, most of the time, a pretty good working relationship with that. And we worked in that pattern through all the years that I worked with him. Now, the first year or two, we did not do that because I was new to it. The first year I was a graduate assistant, as we mentioned earlier, but certainly for the last 14 of those 16 years, that's pretty much the way we worked.
And the budget, is it fair to characterize it as pretty much growing through that whole period?
It did grow, and I didn't check to see what level we were at when I first came into summer sessions and when Clay left. But yes, we were in a growth mode. And I'm trying to think of the phrase that we used to use in those days. It was sort of like you got increases based on the number of students enrolled. I was always a little bit nervous about that particular approach to funding because I worried about, well, what happens if numbers decline? Might there not be some other ways to balance this out? But that was pretty much how the institution as a whole was funded, whether it was summer sessions or the quote-unquote regular academic year. And that may have then accounted for some of the scrambling that we all needed to do when we got into the later 80s, mid to late 80s.
Yeah, we see a totally different picture there.
Yes.
We'll be talking about that in just
yeah.
a little while. Was the growth, were there any periods during these 16 years that you worked for Clay where there was just a spectacular surge, or was it pretty much a steady?
Well, there was a very high enrollment already in the summer of 1969, way up over 14,000 students. And then we would sort of go up and down a little bit within that range, maybe down to 13,000. I should have the data lying in front of me. I've kind of put it behind me. But 69 already was a high summer session enrollment year on the Madison campus. And then we, of course, entered the 70s, where we and other parts of the university really had to help out the medical school because some of the soft monies were drying up, as it were. So early on in the 70s, each school or college did have to go back and re-examine its fiscal situation and sort of kick back, as it were, some dollars to help the medical school.
So you actually have to put real dollars
yes,
on the table.
Yes, and actually I believe every school and college was pretty much in that position. And that was one of the years in the early 70s. So there were those kinds of cooperative efforts that went on. Now that was not just summer session, that was for the medical school as a whole. There were some tough times for them, which is kind of hard to believe, but
I was going to put this question a little bit later, but since we're right in this period right now, let's go with it. The late 60s and 70s were very famous years on the UW mm-hmm. campus, a lot of student unrest, which culminated, of course, in the bombing of Sterling Hall. Mm-hmm. Did such events as the campus protest marches and the bombing of Sterling Hall, did they have any impact on summer sessions?
I think from a public relations perspective, yes, they did, because in general, parents became somewhat leery of sending their young people to the campus because they had a vision of the National Guard, and they had a vision of tear gas, and they had a vision of the marching and the chanting, and of course we got a lot of television coverage. Mm-hmm. And then the bombing of Sterling in the summer of 70, I believe that was, got an awful lot of media coverage. And I think that there was some effect for a period of time. There was also an effect on how we felt as employees.
How so?
It's very tiring. I'm not saying that I agreed or disagreed with the kinds of philosophical things that students were dealing with, but by the time all of the protests pretty much ended, somewhere in the 70s, people who were involved in administration or student affairs, I can't speak for the faculty, were just really, it's like, we didn't realize how tired we were, because there was a stress that was involved over that period of time. Certainly when we were still located in the Towers building, the National Guard was always marshaled right beneath our windows on State Street, across from between the Brat House, what was mm-hmm. then called the Brat House, and the Towers building. So there were, on some occasions, tear gas in our building. And I remember one time when Clay was determined to leave no matter what. And at that time, he had a convertible. And he drove out from the small parking lot next to the Towers building. And we were all sort of peering down from the second floor windows to State Street, wondering, would he make it out? And you may well want to ask him about that, because there were a lot of students surrounding that convertible. Mm. And, a little bit of pushing and shoving.
I mean, surrounding him just because he was a part of the administration?
Not only was the National Guard marshaling there, but most of the protest marches started usually from about that area on State Street near the Towers building. So that was a time when a march was assembling and the Guard were there, and Clay, no matter what, he was going to get out of that parking lot and go. Well, he did make it out, but we were all a bit nervous, and the car was being shaken a bit by students who were pushing on it and so on. So there were those kinds of things. And I think there was an impact on enrollment for a while.
Did you, or did your staff or your PR person, did you go out and try to correct that image that was out there? Do you remember?
Isn't it terrible how the decades go by? I'm sure we did, because one of Clay Shainfield's areas of expertise is public relations. And of course, Susan Dish was the person most intimately involved. So we were always cognizant of what was going on campus and what was going on in the larger media. So I'm sure that was being dealt with.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that question comes compliments of Susan Dish, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. she had experienced a lot of the same things that you had mm-hmm. in that period. You mentioned your facilities at the Towers. When did you leave those? When did you move to?
I believe we moved from the Towers to 433 North Murray in 1973.
Okay.
And 433 North Murray is a three-story flat.
It was apartments, right?
Yes.
Helen C. White used to live
White and
perhaps Leonard, the English professor,
yeah.
I think he lived there too.
Yes, he did. He did. They both lived there at one point. So, what was Leonard's first name?
It's escaping me right now. The locomotive god.
Yes.
William Ellery Leonard.
That's it, William Ellery Leonard. And he never went beyond the railroad tracks. Those were his parameters.
Yeah, he had some real
Yeah, because of his
traits.
Phobia.
Phobias, yeah. Mm-hmm,
about railroads and locomotives in particular.
So tell me a little bit about your facilities over there. How did the movement come about in the first
place? Well, we were growing.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed more space. And basically, at the Towers building, we had like three big rooms and Clay's office. That was about what we had. And the numbers of students were increasing because by then we were officially the office for non-degree students year-round. And at that time, also, the Housing Bureau was being dissembled, which was then located at 433 North Murray. And that sort of came about with a shift in student services. There were changes made. Remember, F. Chandler Young was Vice mm-hmm. Chancellor for Academic Services. And so the Housing Bureau was sort of dissolved. And Newell Smith went back to Slichter Hall as head of residence halls. And fraternity sorority advisors were moved back to the union. That sort of thing mm-hmm. was going on.
With decentralization.
Yeah, yes. So then it was the only space available, apparently, at that point. So we moved to this old three-story flat. Did the best we could and were in that until the fall of 1988, when we moved to 905 University Avenue, which was at one point a bank building mm-hmm. and is now sort of a designated student services building. And that may end in the next years also.
Yeah, we'll be talking yeah. about your residency yeah. there. How sufficient was this new building to your needs?
It was never really sufficient. It was a challenge to make an understatement. It was a real challenge because we were dealing with, as the years went by, thousands and thousands of students each semester. And if you can imagine receiving that many students in a very, you know, what amounted to a very tiny living room. With no appropriate no appropriate hallways, no appropriate bathrooms, none of the bathrooms accessible. It was very difficult. And developing a file room in what had been a dining room, you know, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And then running students and file folders up to second floor and to third floor to see advisors. It was hard.
There were no elevators there.
No elevators. And we finally set up our public relations duplicating printing operation in the basement. And of course, this is a 1920s, probably, three-story flat. So we were frequently running from the basement to the third floor and vice versa. And someone like Susan Dish was supervising people who were located on third, second, first, and the basement. Very difficult, yeah. Charming but difficult.
So the move was very much welcome.
It was welcome, but it was still a challenge yeah. to try to function given the variety of functions that we had to administer and given the nature of those functions.
Again, I'm getting ahead of myself because that's getting into the Sampson years when you mm-hmm. do the move. So let's mm-hmm. finish off Clay's tenure as director with just one or two other quick questions. When we started talking about your arrival in summer sessions, I think you discussed the four or five permanent people who were on staff mm-hmm. and then this shifting variety mm-hmm. of people who would come in and work for mm-hmm. a summer, a year, mm-hmm. and then leave. How did the staff grow over those years, first in the Towers and then over on Murray Street?
Well, in the Towers it grew to, we added a shipping and mailing clerk and Then I was assistant director, and we added another graduate student who was doing some of the kinds of things that I had done when I first began with summer sessions. And I did have a secretary then. Initially, I did not. And we always had some part-time student help. But by the time that Clay retired at the end of June of 1984, we had, two and a half advisors, 2.5 advisors, and we had an assistant for Susan in public information as well as a secretary, full-time secretary in that area, and we always had at least one graduate assistant, sometimes two, to help us with the literally hordes of data that we were developing, because I'd mentioned in our first interview that because there were people who were not necessarily totally receptive to the non-degree student operation year-round, all of us felt that we really needed to be prepared to answer any question. And so we gathered data. I mean, we could answer any question. And when we couldn't, it was very easy for us to go and find those answers or dig out a little more data. So, and Clay, of course, had, as he'd had earlier, a full-time secretary. And he was still working with the Center for Environmental Communications and Educational Studies. So there were usually one or two graduate students affiliated with that. And we had a file clerk and two receptionists who backed up one another and also did work for the advisors and who helped with the admissions application processing when we began to use a database and monitors, that kind of thing. And of course, we continued with our admissions examiner and Dorothy Dislin. So I don't know, we were approaching 20 people or thereabouts, and sometimes adding some part-time students for a little while at the heavy admissions registration periods or at the heavy public relations periods when the timetable and so on were being put together and needed to be delivered. And we also did a lot of other things. We were the campus's bicentennial office for 2 years when the nation celebrated the bicentennial. And so then there were a couple of extra people sort of slotted in on a part-time basis to help with that. And we also helped to bring up the extended day timetable. When Extension was moving most of its credit courses out of Extension and back onto the campuses. So, and Joe Corey was the person designated on the Madison campus to be involved with extended day. But we, Susan Dish in particular, did put together those extended day timetables for several semesters. And Peg Geisler, excuse me, was also part of our division on a part-time, very part-time basis during some of those years when continuing education services was developed. And that was in the early 70s that was developed, an advising office for returning adults thinking about coming back to the university, either as undergrads or grads or returning for the first time. That office now has a totally new name, which I can't begin to tell you. It's much longer than continuing ed services. But so there were a lot of things happening during that time.
You said that Clay was still spending part of his time with...
I think with the Center for Environmental Communications and Educational Studies, and I think a little bit with wildlife ecology. There was a time where that... that ended as far as the wildlife ecology, but I don't remember just
yeah, where. He did become a full-time dean eventually.
I think so, awfully close to it, yes.
You mentioned, and we were going to talk about this afterwards, I didn't realize it was really directly related to the summer sessions, the Bicentennial Committee Festival. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that for a minute. Mm-hmm. What did that do? What was it?
It was big. we basically coordinated the campus for a weekend celebration, which was actually joint celebrating the bicentennial and celebrating the opening of the Lower State Street Mall. And we always jokingly said, who else could have brought together Paul Ginsberg and Paul Soglin on the same podium on the same day, because that was Paul Soglin's first tenure as mayor of Madison when the Lower State Street Mall opened. And Paul Ginsberg, they'd been adversaries of one another when Paul Soglin was a student. And then of course, they were on the same podium dedicating both the mall and the Bicentennial Festival celebration for the Madison campus. That was a fun weekend. But it was a very big activity, and we had the cooperation of literally every aspect of the campus. I mean, from buildings and grounds to the vice chancellor's office to the union, libraries, departments. And we had so many activities that our office was like the Charlie checkpoint, as it were, for all of the performing groups that came onto campus to help us celebrate. And Bob Bell, I remember, assistant director then, he arranged for fireworks out over Lake Mendota from the Union Terrace. I mean, he had to find a shooter, which is the technical term for someone who sets off really big fireworks. And we had Doc DeHaven and his group for a jazz performance. We had the Coty dancers. We had we had many, many performances. We had Uncle Sam on his
himself
on his stilts, handing out I think maybe little flags to children. We had some children's activities going on. We had film. We had theater. We even had Babcock Dairy produce an ice cream, develop and produce an ice cream just for the festival, which was red, white, and blue. I don't know that they ever made it again after that particular weekend, but it was big. And everyone cooperated, including the weather. It was just gorgeous weather, so it was very successful. What another interesting thing with the mall just opening, most people may not realize it, but there is a checkerboard or chessboard on the Lower State Street Mall just outside of the University Club, between the University Club and the Historical Society. And so we had a living chess game being performed that day as well. And that was to replicate, in a sense, what had happened at the centennial celebration in the East in 1876 when they had a living chess game. So there were a lot of things woven in to the festival.
Well, that's interesting, it's the festival itself, but the fact that Summer Sessions was put in charge of that, I find really, really fascinating.
Well, I think, again, the reason for that is the budget title for the division had been Summer Sessions and Intercollege Programs for many years. Then, so Clay always referred to us as being ambidextrous, and I think that that's true. So when the university decided that it would be part of this celebration, our division was designated as this intercollege operation for the bicentennial year. And so reports came out of there, and then, of course, the festival was, in a sense, our own contribution. I mean, other things were happening around the campus over those 2 years, but that was the item that we did as a division, as well as being the office for the campus for the bicentennial.
I'm assuming that it sounds like everything went off very well.
It was fabulous.
if you do say so.
Yes,
myself.
I'm sorry. We have to say that. I mean, I even remember Susan Dish and Bob Bell and I pushing a piano across the mall because the Doc DeHaven jazz group needed to have one, and we sort of had to store it in the library during the day, and then the three of us pushed it down the mall to the appropriate. So it was, and the neatest thing, and we've lost it. Several people in the community wrote a skit about the Red Gym.
Oh.
And we're, of course, sitting in the Red Gym right now doing this interview. And it was presented in the Red Gym on one of the days of the festival, and it was almost like the story of what had happened over the years in this very historic facility.
It's very historic,
and I feel really badly that somehow that got out of our hands and we were never able to get a hold of it again. So I think it was a wonderful...
It's a very interesting building, history-wise. Yeah. There are many significant things that have happened in here. That's very interesting. I wasn't aware of that bicentennial celebration, even though I realized I lived in Madison at the time.
Well, not everyone came,
obviously,
Barry.
Obviously, you missed some people at least. Now, let's talk about you during these Schoenfeld years before we leave them entirely. You were a graduate student, then you became an assistant dean. Did you become an associate dean during the Clay's years or not?
Yes, I did. I'm not an associate dean, but an associate director.
Associate director,
yes.
I'm sorry.
And had that position for, I can't remember how many years, a fair number.
Was there anything that led up to that, or was that just a title change that came around, or was it considered a promotion for you? Or?
Well, it was a promotion, and I think that Clay felt that given the expanded responsibilities that we had, and one of those that we haven't even talked about, I mean, there were so many, was to become the office for some of the summer programs for minority and or disadvantaged youth, the terminology we used then. And I think it was about at that time, in roughly 1980, that I became associate director. And we did, until Clay retired, so for at least 5 summers, we were directly responsible for running those programs. An 8-week program in the summer for people graduated from high school, and then several 1-week programs for younger students to begin to give them a taste of what a university or college is about, and giving them interest tests and exposure to different aspects of the university campus. Those were challenges. They were challenges.
In what sense?
Well, it's very difficult. People come with so many different philosophical bases and frameworks to working with youngsters in general, and then youngsters who were less well prepared for the university or college, and especially the residential setting of having students in a dorm for 8 weeks or a week and needing to have rules and regulations in place so that we wouldn't be having difficulties of students being too rowdy or doing things in dorms that really aren't acceptable, and making sure that people understood that alcohol, I mean, strange things like, we always had to say to any youth program, alcohol, drugs, firearms are not. I mean, that's just one of the rules of the university and then of residence halls. And we had a lot of players, because students would be ultimately enrolling perhaps in almost any college or school of the university. And so representatives sat on the advisory committees from many parts of the university. And again, we struggled to try to come to consensus on how we would approach these particular enrichment or enhancement programs. It was a challenge. And we did that initially without any additional staff. Just as we had developed the year-round Office for Non-Degree Students without additional staff initially. So
now, asking you to search your memory banks again, it's very interesting. I didn't realize that these programs started at this point in time.
Well, some were already in existence. I wouldn't want to confuse people. But there was a decision that the 8-week program be transferred under the purview of the Division of Summer Sessions and Intercollege Programs at that point. And the 1-week sessions were new. We developed them, but we sort of inherited the 8-week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And those programs pretty much have continued over time?
They have. What has happened is when Clay retired, one of the first things that Harlan Sampson did was to begin to transfer those programs back to a school or a college, so that they left the immediate operation of the division that I was part of, and budgetary and public information and certain general university rules and regs and some other kinds of youth program materials continued to be developed by our division, but they left our purview as far as operation.
Normally, I would say, let's wait until we get to the Sampson years to finish that off, but since we are so close,
well,
why did it go back to the schools or colleges? Why did Harlan make that switch?
I'm not sure if he felt, I'm really not sure, if he felt that perhaps they more rightly belonged within a given school or college, or if he felt that it was an aspect of perhaps streamlining the division. I'm really not clear.
Okay.
Yeah.
When Clay left, did he retire?
Yes, he retired in June of 84.
Looking back from your perspective at your 16 years with mm-hmm. him and the history of summer sessions as they've mm-hmm. evolved, as they evolved before mm-hmm. and since, what would you consider his strongest contribution to the division in his years as director?
Well, I think one we talked about earlier was the dean's advisory group or advisory council to pull together all of the parties that offered summer session of one sort or another on the Madison campus. I think the creative, innovative course funding, which allowed for a forum among the summer deans to help decide which courses should be provided with those developmental dollars, and they might be an engineering course, LNS, pharmacy, in other words, it cut across the campus. I think the fact that the three-week intersession developed, that was new. It wasn't new to the country as a whole. There were some other institutions doing it, but that was new to this campus. I think the realizing that there'd been a shift in when summer courses were being offered in a week to emphasize the four-day week, but still work at having weekend courses where it was appropriate or necessary. I think all of those were important elements. I think the fact that he continued to persuade and to reinforce that it's important that summer session dollars remain separate. There was an experiment sometime in the 60s where dollars were given directly to the schools and colleges that should also carry over into summer. And basically what happens then is the dollars are, figuratively speaking, burned up. He stood that by that very firmly of maintaining that dollars do need to be separate for summer. He never really caved into the almost repeated attempts to try to pay faculty in a different way rather than the formula that was part of this campus and then of the system based on the previous academic year's salary and a formula related to whether it was an eight-week course or a four-week course. So I think, there are other things too, but those are the areas that really stand out in my mind. And he had always a very good historical perspective of the institution. He had been an assistant to President E.B. Fred when Clay was pretty young, so he had learned a lot from E.B. Fred, and we frequently got tidbits of wisdom and morsels of information about that, which also for me was very interesting and very helpful. There's a continuity and there is an historicity, which I think if we don't have, we're lacking. And,
well, if he worked for E.B. Fred, he sure got it because E.B. is just studied the history of this institution like few people who have been here have ever had.
Mm-hmm.
So, Clay leaves. Leaves the summer session, and your new dean is Harlan Sampson, who had previously served as the associate dean for School of Education. And so you knew him, did you not, through the dean's council?
Yes, because Harlan had been the representative from the School of Education to the summer session's dean's council. We also were members together with others on the space remodeling and policy committee.
We'll be talking
about
that.
Am I saying that committee right?
Probably.
Space and Remodeling Policies Committee. That was it, yeah.
That sounds like it, yes. Yes, Space and Remodeling Policy Committee. Had you had an opportunity when he was on the Dean's Committee to work with him, or did you just mainly observe him?
No, I had some opportunity to work with him, particularly when we were making the decision of whether or not there should be the one-week programs for minority disadvantaged students in summer, and then when they were reviewed, he was part of that evaluation committee. So there was, a tie-in directly there. And sometimes with special students in summer, the School of Education, of course, has many returning adults in summer session, but they also have them, in fall and spring. And frequently special groups were being served through our special student office, so we would have and I would have interaction with Harlan then. So yes, there was interaction.
Now, during the Schoenfeld years, we just talked about the expansion of growth that went on. What happened after that?
I would characterize the next 5 years prior to my retirement as a period of almost decimation. That may be a bit strong, but when you are in a situation where you move from one of growth and incorporating a lot of different kinds of activities and weaving those in and juggling them to an era in which, of course, funds were becoming more restricted and constricted, but also perhaps administrative styles were different. That was a difficult adjustment for me, because I think that I'm somebody who can handle a lot of different things, and I like to always look at, well, how can we do this? Mm-hmm. You know, what's the problem? Okay, how can we work with it and make it happen? And it's much harder for me to deal with, well, we've got a problem and now we're going to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. I tend to be the other kind of person, I guess, to figure out creatively how can we still be serving this population or do this program even though there are constraints.
What about, you said administrative style, we're going to be getting into the reduction, enrollment management, budget reduction, all that in just a few minutes, but what was so different about Harlan's, let's compare, even though this isn't always fair to do,
right.
Harlan's enrollment, administrative style with Clay's,
well,
in terms of how you reacted in
Well, everyone is different, and everyone brings different skills to any situation. So I'm not really talking about skills. I'm talking more about style. And I think Clay is one of those people, too, who thrives on having a lot of things going. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the juggler kind of person. And I don't know, maybe as I look back, maybe Harlan's style is more... the tennis player, the ball that we're...
Volley.
Yeah, the volley kind of thing. And while I like to play tennis, I think I'm more the juggler. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... So that was hard to adjust to. And I realized probably some of what we were seeing was because of budget constraints. But some of it, I think, may well have been because of different styles.
Could you give an example of that? I'm interested.
Well, when we went to enrollment management, and of course there were several times we did that. We actually had to do that when Clay was still director, dean also. But we usually tried to parse the sentence, as it were, many ways, or cut the sheet in as many places as possible to figure out how we could... within all the rules and regulations, still serve as many people as really needed to be served. That was harder to do under the administration with Dean Sampson. Now, he may have been constrained by the Hill as well, and I'm not real clear on that. But I guess all I can say is my style was always, how can we figure out how to make it possible, rather than to just always eliminate, but... And I suppose, in all honesty, I felt like I was seeing my baby being pulled apart, sort of, you know, one toe at a time, as it were. I don't know if that's really a very good analogy, but, and that was hard.
In other words, a lot of your programs that you felt you were partly responsible for developing.
Yeah,
were being
and that the staff were responsible for, because, you know, one person can't do it all. We're being taken elsewhere or put elsewhere, or that's very hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard to keep your own creative energies going when that's happening.
When the shift was made to the Sampson years, Did this start happening pretty much right away, or was there a little honeymoon period of a year or two?
No, because the minority disadvantaged summer programs went almost immediately, first one and then the other.
And those went back to the
Eight-week went, I believe, to the College of Letters and Science, and I just can't remember what happened to the one-week ones, whether... I can't say, because that's like how many years ago?
Well,
yeah, almost 9 years ago.
So they weren't necessarily eliminated, these programs.
No.
Some of them were moved to other divisions.
Yeah, and we still had minimal involvement, budgetarily, or... Well, not so minimal in public relations, but it wasn't as though we never talked about them again or thought about them, but that direct, what I call hands-on, was gone. And I guess I am a hands-on person. I'm also, I've always done both. If I'm talking theory, I always need to look at the hands-on too, because I don't think one can just theorize without looking at the practical implications of implementing. And for me, the two are equal when it comes to administration and program development. So that was also a difference in style. That may well have been a difference in style between not only Harlan and me, but Clay and me. Mm-hmm. Just, it's who I am, you know, and we're all different, so.
Yeah, aren't we though? When I interviewed Dean Sampson a few months ago, in his last days before his retirement,
in June,
he identified five key issues as occupying most of his deanship. And I'd like to talk briefly about each one of those five, and then talk about some of the other activities that you might have been involved with during your last 6 years, right? You were
five and a half years
from the time Sampson came into when you retired.
Right.
So some of these may not have been totally operational. We talked a little bit about enrollment management.
Right.
Were there decrees to actually cut enrollments?
Yes, because when Ken Shaw came as president of the University of Wisconsin system, as I recall, he came almost primarily with one main issue, and that was to manage, i.e. reduce enrollment throughout the system. And that was one of his efforts as president of the system. So,
was that something that you felt, thinking back on it, he had been told to do? Was that his...
It may have been.
I mean, did he just come in here with this idea
to
cut enrollments?
No, that may have really come from the regents. It may have come from how times were changing in higher ed, and it was sort of a buzzword across the nation, I think, enrollment management, and it still is to a certain extent, but as some of us have said, well, once you've done that, then what? What's the next?
Yeah, right.
What's the next main issue, you know?
Yeah, did I really? I had to keep my mouth.
Oh, I'm glad you did.
Okay, we're going again. Budget reduction. Mm-hmm. That goes right along hand in hand with enrollment management, in this case, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Were they draconian, or...
How do you mean?
I mean, were they terribly, terribly severe, these budget cuts, budget reductions?
Well,
because you
they were
actively
coming.
Involved with the budget.
They were coming, yeah, they were coming. It meant looking even more stringently at courses that weren't quote-unquote making enrollment in the summer. And I think in the earlier years, we would look even more carefully at, well, it's true this course only has 10 people, but look at what the course is and what it's offering, and look at the kind of student that's enrolled. And we became a little more... disciplined? I don't mean that we were undisciplined, but it seemed to me it was harder for all of us to begin to look at individual needs or small group needs, because the larger picture was to be cutting budgets and to be cutting courses.
The word that's coming into my head, and I don't know if this was a word that was used during this period, but it's accountability.
Yeah, it is accountability, but you know, what definition of accountability is being used? I mean, that was something I struggled with all the time. If accountability is to be able to sort of lay open your entire division to anybody who wants to come in and look at it in terms of what's being done and what it's costing and the kinds of students, we could do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was not a problem. If that's one's definition of accountability, then I feel our division was doing that, could do that. If accountability has a different kind of definition, which I'm not sure what that is, that, I never had it defined for me. What does that really mean? You know, what are we being accountable about?
Well, if you only have 10 students in a course and you need 12 students to break even, do we eliminate that course simply based on the fact that it isn't earning its way?
Do we, or do we look at a semester or a summer session as a whole and say, when we take the whole into account, we have more than accounted for the dollars outlaid? And in fact, in summer, we always brought in more dollars than were laid out to fund faculty and staff. Now, we have not been a self-support summer session on this campus, at least in my, you know, tenure, but and so we weren't paying for all of the facilities and all of the overhead. But on the other hand, you and I know that those facilities would still be open even if the summer session were not, you know, running at full speed, which it pretty much has been through these past decades. So that was always an interesting dilemma for me.
Yeah, it seems just, and I'm making a generalization here, I realize it, but it seems like there's a real difference in philosophy that's coming across at the top level with Buzz Shaw within the summer sessions itself.
From my perspective, yes. And certainly at the very end, when there was, well, even after I retired, in the latter years that Harlan was dean of summer session, he had to struggle with reductions in summer session dollars per se, as did other deans around the system. I mean, it was like initially $5 million was going to be cut from the summer sessions. And I don't know where that $5 million was going to go.
If it was going to go anywhere.
Yes, exactly. So that had to have been very difficult for Harlan and the other deans around the system to start dealing with, mm-hmm. because having worked with the budget for many years, it was hard for me to see that there was quote-unquote fat in the budget kind of thing. So then it means, how many students are you going to prevent from entering courses mm-hmm. that perhaps they really need? You know, that's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a different way of looking at the same issue, which is what we're essentially talking about, the different ways of approaching what was becoming a problem probably pretty much all over campus.
Exactly. And then not only at Madison, but in terms of summer sessions, the other directors or deans around the system.
Well, if Shaw was giving the orders,
that's right.
That would mean
that's
that
right. And so, a time of constraint and difficult, I think, for anyone to be real creative. And I think when creativity is shut down in people, institutions lose a lot, I think. But again, that's a personal perspective. Given my bent for creative kinds of involvement.
You know. You would characterize, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so correct me if I'm wrong, the Shainfeld years as being fairly creative then.
I would. Yeah. I would. And maybe that's true for the campus as a whole in that period of time. It's hard to see it being real creative now. I mean, it's true we're getting new buildings, and maybe other people see that as creative. You see, I guess it's, again, where you...
Well, also, there just was more money coming in the 50s and 60s, and
that's
maybe
right.
money factors into the creativity.
That's right, that's right.
In a bigger way than a lot of people.
Yeah, and others might argue, well, you're going to have to be even more creative now that there are more constraints to be able to deliver.
That's
so.
That's interesting. The third of the five key issues that Dean Sampson listed for me was the upgrading of facilities. You made your, you started out at the towers, right?
That's correct.
So this is your second move now over to
that's right.
what used to be the first Wisconsin Bank, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
On the corner of University and Park.
Yes, 905 University.
Along with the big Bucky clock on the side.
Right,
How did that come about, that you got that particular facility?
Well, Actually, in retrospect, when we moved to 433 North Murray, I think there would have been a possibility to have moved to that former bank building at that time. But I think that Clay Shainfeld felt that the Murray Street situation would be better. Then apparently space became available again in about 1988, yes. And partly it was related to undergraduate admissions, the portion related to my former work way back when in what was then called high school relations. And it's like undergraduate orientation or new student services now. That portion of undergraduate admissions really felt it needed different space. Plus, it was located over a block away, almost two blocks away, from the main area of undergraduate admissions, which is in the A.W. Peterson building. So we actually did a flip-flop with the new student services portion of undergraduate admissions. And vice versa. They moved to 433 North Murray, and we moved to the space that they vacated at 905 University Avenue. And then we also obtained space in the basement of 905, and I really can't remember if a portion of some data processing operation was in that space. I don't remember anymore. So square footage-wise, we gained space. And instead of four floors to operate on, including the basement, we then had a portion of the first floor and a portion of the basement.
And the elevator?
And the elevator.
And it was a handicapped...
That's right, because of the elevator.
Because of the elevator.
Right. And the entrance to 905 is right off the sidewalk, flush. So those aspects were much, much better.
Why didn't Clay take it the first time?
I'm not sure. We all wished he had. He'll probably say he doesn't remember that it was available.
I'll make a note of that so that I ask him. He tries to get away with it. So right away there was a real improvement.
Yes, in terms of people being able to get in and out and an accessible bathrooms and a loading dock. Well, we sort of had a loading dock at 433 North Murray. I mean, physical plant added a little platform on the back, but...
It's a very charming facility, one on Murray Street, but
yes.
I can see how it would be difficult.
Yeah, you know, if you just had offices where you were interviewing for the oral history, that it would be wonderful.
Yes, right.
But where you have to have a flow of many, many people, then it's very different. Of course, now the flow of people has changed dramatically. Two, because of the change in registration processes with automated registration and change in admission processes. So I don't think they see the hordes of people all at the same time that we did.
That you had that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The fourth issue that Harlan lists is streamlining the operation,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty much goes right along with enrollment management,
mm-hmm.
budget,
mm-hmm.
And budget reduction. Did you see the operation as in need of streamlining because of these different things that were taking place?
I don't know. That was that's sort of like the word accountability.
Okay.
It depends on what the definition is and what it is that one is looking for. Obviously, when you are doing fewer things, you have, by virtue of doing fewer things, streamlined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just don't have as much on your plate anymore, as it were. So, and with budget becoming even more of a problem, I suppose there then was a need to rid oneself of certain aspects of the operation.
Were any personnel released or transferred during those years?
Yeah, we did. When the assistant director, then dean, retired, that position was not filled.
Mm-hmm.
There was an individual who was half-time assisting Harlan with some aspects of his work, but
we never really refilled that full position. So that was one thing that did go with streamlining, with cuts.
Yeah. The final issue that you talked about was strengthening and enhancing the creative side of summer sessions. Mm-hmm. Several programs were started mm-hmm. during these
well,
years.
I know one of the programs, I was really only in on the beginning stages of it, was Windows on the World. And Harlan may have mentioned that. Mm-hmm. And I think that was run for about 5 summers, each summer with a different, with a focus on a different part of the globe. China was one.
Was it run for university students or younger students?
It was within the summer session. For example, there might have been an art exhibit at the Memorial Union, and there might have been a course or two for credit that focused specifically on the area of the world that was in the spotlight or the window was opened on, so to speak. And there might have been some films run during a week or every week over an 8-week summer session. And then usually a seminar or workshop also revolving around the particular area of the world that was in focus. So I know it ran at least for 5 summers. I'm not sure if it ran beyond that, because mm-hmm. I would have been retired and not as in tune. So that was a program that did come up.
Yeah, I think one of the things we haven't talked about are just many of the amazing summer programs for the grade schools mm-hmm. up into the high schools that continued throughout this period
that started
a different part. College for Kids, for example, is run by summer sessions.
Well, it's really a school of education program, but that is run in the summer, yes. And that was one of the programs that did receive an award for creative programming through the North American Association of Summer Sessions. And Computer Fest was another, and one year the University Forum received an award, though the Forum has gone on for decades. One of its particular focuses brought it an award. Mm-hmm. So any number of our summer programs have been not only appreciated by us and our students, but recognized by others.
Now, are the programs that are run by various schools, like School for Kids through Ed, the music school programs through music school, mm-hmm. are they coordinated with you, or how does that operate?
I don't know how it is now, 4 years after I've retired, but one of the things that we always tried to do was bring together coordinators or directors of the summer youth programs at least once each year, so that each one wasn't reinventing the wheel on the various rules and regulations that they needed to be aware of, or the services that they might obtain from the Student Health Center, or the insurance that athletic sports groups would need to pay and cover because of the risk involved. So we always, and I usually did that, and Susan Dish was always a part of that too, so that we could brief those people or their representative and do it in one big setting, and then let them know what services we could provide them for the upcoming summer session for their program or programs. So that's how we handled that. And we usually did a brochure that incorporated all of the summer youth programs. A little blurb about each one and the age group or groups that could be involved in it, and the dates that the program ran and the coordinator and who to contact for more information. And we did a youth program health form so that if any of their potential participants had special needs, either food or otherwise, they could cull that information and do it on the same form. We had an ID card that we developed that we provided to each of the participants if they had their participants pay the segregated fees in order to use the natatorium or the Southeast Recreational Facility or to access the libraries, that kind of thing. So a lot of those basic administrative mm-hmm. kinds of things we tried to cover and to keep them apprised of. And if there were any changes, we could do that. If there were problems in the dorms, we always had a Res Halls representative, Memorial or Student Union representative, that kind of thing.
always to sort of look at the institution as a whole, mm-hmm. and to keep it as coordinated and integrated as possible, rather than everyone off in his or her little corner, unaware of what they needed to know.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Yes, I taught College for Kids for one summer.
Oh, you did?
On history of education.
Oh.
I had emeritus professors who lived near the campus. Uh-huh. The last day, everyone went out and interviewed each one,
uh-huh.
and then gave reports. And if those kids learned about half as much as I did, they'll
come away. Well, wonderful. I mean, I remember there was a problem with parking one year with College for Kids or Computer Fest, one of those. And I remember being out and noticing it. So we really tried to beef up the parking situation another year. That kind
yes,
of thing.
All those
I mean,
real nitty-gritty
whatever.
Technical types
whatever.
Of we've talked about what Dean Sampson saw as the five key issues occupying a good deal of his time as dean. You served under him for how many years?
A little over five.
During those years, what did you see as your major job responsibilities and your major accomplishments as associate director?
Then I was associate dean.
Harlan came in as dean.
Rather than director.
Okay.
Yes.
So you mm-hmm. got the name change.
Yeah, so I got the name change, right? Well, those were very hard years because the developments were not what I would call growth. They were developments that involved change, but change in a way that reduced things. And it also involved a lot of work with enrollment management. We had to put into place, I've blotted on the things we had to put into place because they were really tough to try to keep students out who really wanted to access classes. And as I mentioned in the first interview, we always had in place that the non-degree student could not register until all other students had first had their turn in the registration priority. And so frequently, even under enrollment management, professors were more than willing to take, you know, one or two students into their classes, but we couldn't do it because of enrollment management. So, and it was always interesting to me that that the campus got more money to add on more classes for new freshmen so that they would not have to wait a couple of semesters before getting classes they needed. And we knew that there were open spaces, but we just couldn't do it. So all I can say is it was the hardest 5.5 years I ever put in my working career, because it was reduce, constrain, deny. I mean, that's how I perceived it.
Okay.
Others might not have seen it that way, but it was almost taking a 180-degree turn, and it was hard. Mm-hmm. And then it was gearing up. Oh, well, now we can take more students. Now try to get them. Then it was, no, now we've got to cut more, do things to... So it was...